Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have you joining us again here. We're back with the part two of the episode we started last week with our special segment on a significant USAR training event that Dr. Joe Holly attended and helped with the training for, along with Patrick McDevitt, a 20-year firefighter paramedic and a member of Tennessee Task Force One's USAR team. He went out and participated in this training evolution with California Task Force One. And we're going to pick up with part two of that segment that we looked at the amazing stuff they did and the types of real-life rescue evolutions they went through with this program. So we're going to, without further ado, join you. We also had Kyle Nelson on the show with us, along with my co-host Sam Bradley. And we went ahead and jumped in and asked a lot of great questions and found out some amazing things about the type of training that this USAR team in California does on a regular basis. Check it out.
Tell us about the final drill, Patrick.
Okay, so we started on Monday and we hit the ground running Monday. Again, like I said, you know, 14-hour days, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So day four of the course was our long day. We broke probably around 3 p.m. No, actually, it was closer to 4. And we came back for a scenario that started at 8 p.m. And this is after we have done different scenarios leading up to this. So this was kind of our, you know, final performance here, I guess, if that's the best way to put it. And so what they did is they just gave us one big, huge scenario. And each individual team was given an assignment. One team would go to the front of the building. One team would go to the right side of the building. One team would go to the back of the building. I think they had a below grade scenario set up that was supposed to be the basement of the building. And so they deployed each individual team to different parts of this huge structure they had set up, just one big structural collapse structure. And each team was equally equipped with the same amount of gear that we'd been using all week long. So we had a good idea at that point, and we knew each other at that point as to who was going to work and how people were going to work. So what we did was we just kind of held a pre-deployment meeting, just saying, okay, who's going to lead this team? Who's going to be entry team? Who's going to be backup team? Who's going to handle logistics and documentation? And I think everyone just kind of played to their strengths and things that they wanted to do and things that they were good at right there, because we had all taken turns doing everything at that point. So we were given a scenario of we're going to be in the Bravo Charlie corner, facing the building. That's the left rear corner. And the report was there were three patients trapped back there, and our mission was to go get them. And that's all we really knew. We weren't given a time frame. We weren't given locations. We weren't given possibilities of injuries, ages, anything like that. It was, we suspect there are three people back here. We need you guys to go in there and search and see what you got. And that's what we did. We had three separate patients back there that we had to go find. We deployed as two different teams. We had a first entry team and a second entry team. Each team had two people in it. I was on the first entry team with a partner, and we took a couple of little small go bags with us that we could push through with us. One of the things that I'd learned before I'd gotten in this class is anytime you get into a space that's small where you're going to have to crawl and work in and everything, you don't think about this a lot. Clear it out as much as you can. Push everything off to the side. If you can hand rubble or debris out, if you're 5 feet into a gap in a building and there's a chair in there, hand it out to the people. Make room. And so that was something that helps, and it's going to help you get to the patient. It's also going to help you get the patient out of there. So that's something that we did. If you want to, I can describe what we saw when we were inside our patients, or you want me to stop there, or what are y'all looking for here?
No, do tell. We're enjoying the hell out of this.
Okay.
It's giving me a picture I've never really had before of the parts of USAR that I've obviously never been involved in. So I'm sure the rest of the guys feel the same way.
Okay, so if you can imagine me, I am about 5'10", 175 pounds. So average size guy, you know, not slim, not real muscular, just an average size person. And the gear that we wear is not a firefighter helmet, but a search and rescue helmet. Kind of looks like a modified construction helmet. And you've got a light. Most people have a light on their helmet. You've got long sleeve shirt, pants, boots, steel toe boots, knee and elbow pads. You're wearing a dust mask and eye protection. And then you've also got hearing protection. And so that's what you're going in with. So you don't have anything bulky that you have to squeeze through other than just you and what you're taking with you. So our entry point, if you can imagine, was about 6 inches off the ground and was the shape of, let's just go with an isosceles triangle that was standing on its point. So your entry that you had to go into was squared on the upper right side, but it was diagonal on the lower side. So the first thing you had to do to go in through this, and it was probably about 2.5, maybe 3 feet across. So first thing you had to do was just lie flat and go into the building there. And when you get in there, they had it set up with, there were wires, there was chunks of concrete, there was a file cabinet literally laying right in the middle of the floor, wires hanging from the ceiling and things like that. And so since we had been through these things before, we're trying to figure out what we need to do. Sorry, that's my clock there. In order to get the patient out. So my partner went in first. I went in behind her. And as she was crawling under wires going towards the patient, we stay in voice contact. I had the radio with me. She would relay back to me, and I would relay back to the team outside. She would crawl under a set of wires, phone cables, things like that. And I had a set of shears. I just started cutting because the last thing you want to do is get tangled up and things like that. And then I would take debris and push it over in the corner. She eventually got to the patient, and our patient, if I'm not mistaken, was a – and these were, as Doc said, these were actually volunteer patients that they had placed in the hole. And when we say hole, we don't mean underground. It's just a hole in the rubble is where we went. This person was probably – alert, but let's just say a little disoriented. And I think she had been in the building for approximately maybe half of a day or so. And so, you know nothing about this patient. You have no information. So we have to get in there and assess. We have to get vital signs. You have to get blood pressure, pulse, mental status, check blood sugar, ask them what's going on, if they can talk to you. And then you start your treatment, you know. We carry an IV kit in there. We try to be as aseptic as possible. We didn't actually start an IV on our patient, but we did, set the IV drip set up. We had it pre-staged to where it was set up, where we could carry it in, where we didn't have to run our air bubbles out or anything like that. But, we simulated starting an IV. We would tape the catheter to the patient's arm, and then we would say, okay, now we have an IV in place. I think she had a fracture on one of her legs, so we would apply a splint to that. And to get to this patient, we had to go through a second hole that was about 3 feet off the ground, so we had to climb up and over and down into some more debris. And this patient could talk, but she wasn't able to move or help us. That was I think she was partially paralyzed. So we had to figure out how to get this patient back out. One of the things you have to do, and I don't think I mentioned this as your team leader, is monitor how long your team is working inside. And when you're inside doing this, you don't consider how long you've been in there. You're trying to consider time on getting the patient out, but you maybe have been in there for 20 minutes and you think it's only about 5. So you're being monitored by the team outside. So you get in there, you stabilize the patient, and a lot of times by the time you get to your patient, you stabilize them. And when you get in there, you need to paint a picture to the people outside. And so it was my job as the second person on the entry team to describe each turn we went through as specific as possible. For example, the first hole we went into, I said, okay, I'm in a void space. It's a chamber approximately 4 feet wide by about 6 feet tall. I can stand in here. There's a lot of rubble on the ground. Appears to be, there's another opening 5 feet directly in front of us that we're going to go to. And you've got a person outside who is taking this image in and drawing a map. So the next team that you send in, or if you have to describe it to another team, they have an idea where you are, and they're marking where patient number one is. They're marking where patient number two is. They're writing everything down as you do it. So that's what you have up to the point of where you get to the patient there. And then obviously once you get to the patient, you have to treat your patient and figure a way to get them out of the hole. What we ended up doing with this person was we wanted to put something on her that we can use that would protect her and also give us access to extricating her. So one of the things that we had at our disposal, we have a Stokes basket, which was way too big and bulky to get in there to where she was, because we had to do some crawling as in addition to going up and over two different holes. The patient's size, this was a full-grown adult who was larger than both my partner and I, so we had to consider that. And then we had to figure out leverage. So what we decided to do was use the use a halfback device, a KED or Yates, you know, depending on where you are. You've got different ones. But, you know, you strap it to the patient's waist, and it's got plenty of support for the patient. It can also be used to slide the patient on their back and protect them, but at the same time had handles that you can grip. So what we would do is, I believe our team had swapped out at that point because where the patient was, there was a big void. And so they were able to send a second team in to relieve us and bring us out, rehab us for a few minutes. And then once we had figured out an extrication plan to get the patient out, they had all four of us in there. And I believe there was one or two team members. And you always want to try to bring your patient out head first if you can, just to kind of, it's a little bit easier to move a patient that way. You don't worry about their arms moving up over their head like you would if they came feet first, or you don't have as much to hang up with. So what we ended up doing was we attached our patient to a KED, laid her flat on her back. We had one person at her feet, and then we attached some webbing straps to the handles to give us a little bit more pulling and leverage room. Slid her on her back for about 15 or 20 feet while, you know, we were on our hands and knees in front and behind her. Then we had to sit her up because we had to get her up a 3-foot lift through another hole. And we just, you know, you use your body as a fulcrum sometimes. I believe I got up, I had swapped with another person and gotten back at her feet because, you know, we were having issues in moving her. And I think what we ended up doing was we had two people lift her up from behind underneath her arms and using some webbing that were through some handles in the straps to raise her up. I positioned myself up underneath her knees and just kind of used my body to push up with, and we just all did it in conjunction. And so when I wrote that in my description of the class, you know, team intensive, it was those kind of things that you had to figure out, because the object is to get them out. The object is not to say, okay, I got them, and I've run out of ideas. What do y'all have? You know, I mean, individually, yes, but as a team, that's not an option. You have to figure out a way as a team to get that patient out, regardless of, you know, any kind of obstacles you come across. And that's what we ended up doing. And it took a while to get her out, probably a little bit longer.
Hold on a second there, Patrick. I think I lost you for a second on the signal. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. You hear me?
Yeah, okay. You can do is you just said, I'm going to pick this up and I'll snip it together. It'll be like nothing happened. Pick up from where you talked about how long it took you to get her out.
Okay. It took us a little bit longer to get her out than we had originally planned on. But in the end, we accomplished the mission, which is find your patient, stabilize your patient, and then safely extricate your patient from this rubble pile. She was probably 25, 30 feet from the entrance point in. But when you're talking about going over rubble, through two different holes, around corners, and having to move a person who can't assist you, it was challenging. So that's what I meant when I said this was probably one of the most team-intensive exercises I've ever done. Because, again, it's not a straight shot where you just pick somebody up and walk them out and you can have as much space as you need and have as many hands as you need. Sometimes you're limited to the space around you, and one person pushes from one end and the other person pulls from the other end and has people behind helping while you're actually sitting a patient up to lift them straight up and through a hole that's 3 feet off the ground and stuff. So,
Patrick, that is such a clear picture. I'm just blown away. But Joe, I want to go back to you. You know, he's talking about starting IVs and certain things. What are some of the key medical issues with people that have been in this situation for a while? So I would guess they're dehydrated. What else are these guys really focusing on in terms of medical care?
Well, I think that's, you know, part of the challenge. It runs the whole gamut of the stuff we see in our normal, you know, day-to-day practice of emergency medicine and EMS. And it's compounded and complexed by long times in the rubble with some unique medical problems like dust impaction in the airways, from, you know, a building collapsing around you. Lots of stuff that we've talked about on this program before, crush syndrome, particularly, you know, the need to perhaps perform a field amputation on someone who's got a, you know, a limb trapped underneath a portion of the building that's not movable, and it's going to be their only means to be able to get them out of there. So, you know, it's Patrick's description was fabulous, but he's also very humble. And you know, those scenarios are quite challenging. You know, what Patrick didn't say is that there were two more patients that they had to deal with further down the hole. One of whom had significant chest trauma and a pericardial tamponade, which you had to diagnose by the most rudimentary methods, meaning like you had to look at and touch the patient. I know that's a little bit unusual anymore, but, you know, you actually had to interact with the patient there. And then you had to decompress a pericardial tamponade underneath the building in the dark, and stabilize that patient. And then yet a third patient who was quite young with a spinal injury and anxiety and some airway issues in a very challenging extrication process. You know, and so that final drill is really designed to put all those skills to work, but to complicate it by not just having one patient, but having multiple patients, all of whom you have to diagnose, all of whom you have to treat, all of whom you have to extricate. And you have to do all that at night, in the dark when you're really tired and, you know, under sort of the worst of all conditions there. So it's designed to stress the team out pretty hard, but it's also designed to show the team what they can do after having spent a week together, working those scenarios and working together in those situations.
So I got to ask, Joe, did you give your hometown boy the worst case scenario, the toughest assignment?
I'll have to say that they had the second worst tunnel as far as just the sheer physical challenges of moving through that tunnel. And they very swiftly recognized and treated a pericardial tamponade, including the use of a simulated I'm not even sure the right word here. We built a simulation of a chest wall with a pericardial sac behind it that they actually had to find the right landmarks and penetrate the skin, quote unquote, over this special mannequin that was made and suck the fluid out of the bag that was the pericardial sac. So it wasn't just talking your way through all that sort of stuff. It was actually doing that procedure in the hole with a real person there who's playing the part and being the victim. You know, there's sharps everywhere and, you know, dust and noise and smoke and dark and, you know, you name it. It's pretty challenging even on the victims that were willing to crawl in that hole and stay there for several hours and then get beat up, you know, getting taken out of there. It's not an easy task. And I think if anybody can tell you that, it would be those folks that posed as the survivors of those scenarios, in that, you know, it was as real as it could possibly get. I mean, they're wearing safety equipment for a reason, and that's because they're helplessly lying on a backboard while somebody drags them through a hole that's 12 inches around and got rebar all over it. So, you know, kudos to the folks that are willing to do that, and to the teams that can do that kind of work.
Yeah, I'd like to tag on to what Joe was saying just for a second. The third patient we had was a 13-year-old female. Again, these are all volunteers that are doing this, but her condition was below the waist paralysis, and she had anxiety and was hysterical. This girl played the part to a T. She must have been an actress or something. I mean, she was screaming, she was hysterical, she was playing the role really, really well. And I'll say
this. She was one of the instructor's daughters.
Yeah, and she did an awesome job, and she did her best to try to stress out the medic that was with her. I was with her. I was kind of his assistant because he was at her side, and I was bringing him equipment. But she gave him all sorts of stress and grief and everything the whole time. And he handled it really, really well. I mean, he was probably the perfect person to be handling her temperament-wise on our team. But it was amazing how quick she would come and go out of it, because an instructor would be right there, and you know, we would be getting ready to do something, and they would hit the timeout button and say, okay, you know, are you okay? They're about to do this to you. And she'd be like, oh, yeah, I'm fine. And they'd be like, okay, go ahead. And then she would just get hysterical again. I thought our volunteers were excellent. And that, you know, was something that was good, I think, to push us, because you're adding the emotional stress on top of the mental and physical stress of being in that situation. Now you've got somebody who is borderline uncooperative. And one of the things we end up doing with her was sedating her in order to reduce her anxiety and assist with getting her out of there. So that was part of the scenario, but it's another stressor they put on us to make things seem realistic.
And how many of you have 13-year-old kids?
Working on that. I'm halfway there with one of mine. So.
Well, there you go. So, Kyle, you're totally geeking out over here on this stuff. What are you thinking?
You know, Sam, hearing from Patrick and Joe tonight, and from your experience as well, and Jamie's, I think it just really kind of drives home that, you know, there are some truly amazing people in this world that are willing to go into places and to perform rescues and tasks and things that we have just, we only are seeing truly from the surface. But, you know, it's folks like Patrick and Dr. Joe and you, Sam, and these urban search and rescue teams nationwide that are leading the charge with this. And I think this goes to show, especially to the public that's listening out there, that there are some really amazing people that can do some amazing things. And, you know, we need to support them in any way that we can, so that they can keep getting this training and building this knowledge and experience, so that when they're called upon, they can act.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a very special group of people that are willing to do this. So, Patrick, I want to share some of your final thoughts, which I thought were really neat. Our instructors were physicians and nurses, paramedics and canine handlers, technical rescue and other specialists who took the terms pride and professionalism to an entirely new level. These folks knew their stuff and pushed us to make sure we became confident enough to work alongside them in those same environments. They were incredible people who I'll take my hat off to any day. I'm tired and sore, but grateful to have had this opportunity to push myself both physically and mentally while learning new techniques to help save people. But don't get me wrong, it's nice to be home now. So, Patrick, are you going to share some of what you learned with your team in Memphis?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just everything from how to put together an IV kit, pre-set up to go into a hold where you don't have to spike the bag, bleed off your air bubble lines. They have a roll set up that they call Scotty roll, which is basically a technique that one of the guys up there named Scotty came up with. And that's pre-staging your NIV bag, 1,000 ml IV bag with a 10-drop set, where you have it already spiked. You already have the air bubbles completely out of it. You put it inside a pressure bag
because you can't use gravity, obviously, if you're going to have somebody land sideways to infuse with. You have all of your catheters pre-staged inside of it, obviously still in the wrapper with your IV prep and everything, and then it's all rolled up kind of like a burrito, and you unroll it in the order that you're using things, and you use the packaging itself as an outer wrapper. Some things that you have to consider is, like I said, we try to keep things as aseptic as possible, but you're working inside an active pile, so you're going to have dust in there. You're going to have some little falling pieces of dirt or concrete or something. So you can take the packaging and use that as a shield to place over the patient's IV site. So little things like that, how to set something up like that. What equipment you may need to take inside a hole with you, what's important and what's not going to work. You may need oxygen inside a hole, but you think about the limitations of the equipment you got to carry in. Little things such as a tourniquet, a tactical tourniquet to apply to somebody for bleeding control. Things to consider packing to take in for things like that. I'll absolutely be sharing those kind of little nuggets of wisdom with other folks that obviously I just had never seen before or even thought about. But simple things like that just make perfect sense for it. And again, the instructors, fantastic. They knew their stuff and they wanted to share things with you because they wanted you to become one of them, because again, we're all urban search and rescue people, but if a building's going to go down on top of a team when they happen to be in there working on other people and they get trapped, well, next team up is going to come in and work on them. So they wanted us to know well enough to save people, not just other people, but how we can help each other. And everybody was super positive, very constructive. When we screwed up, they let us know and they would call us out on it and ask why we would do something. And then you take that as a teaching moment and you learn from it. So the point is of this class is not to go in there, get told something once, do it, and you're perfect. The point is to go in there, try a technique. If it doesn't work out, or if you make a mistake, or if you don't do something, you come back out. And after every scenario we did, we had probably about a 15 or 20 minute debriefing session where we would talk about what worked, what didn't work, what we learned, what we could have done better. And we would go around and ask each person, and each instructor would give us attaboys and kind of shake their finger at us in other places and say, look, this, this wasn't good, but this is what you could have done. Consider this next time. So again, it's a good learning experience because it's not one of those everybody gets a trophy things. It's a, hey, everybody's going to learn, and we're going to make sure you learn it. And so that was probably my biggest take home away from that. All the instructors wanted to make sure we knew what we were doing when we left there. And sometimes it took a couple times.
Well, I've always called Joe my hero, and he's just risen a notch. Any final thoughts, Joe?
How do you operate mute? I'm trying to figure that out. There it is. I got it. I think the whole point of tonight's conversation was to hopefully give people insight into the amazing dedication and amount of work and energy that people put into doing this kind of work. And, we're amazingly lucky to have guys like Patrick that step up and have a great attitude, learn stuff, and come away with it, exactly as you heard, with, some sore muscles, but, hopefully a whole new perspective. And I think, our view of that is just as Patrick said, right? It's all about finding the next generation of people that's got to come replace me and teach this next time. So, I'll probably be calling Patrick going, hey, you want to come teach the next class?
Hey, say the word.
I think he would be perfect. So, Jamie, oh, my God, this is seriously, in the 5.5 years we've done this, one of my top 10 favorite podcasts.
I agree.
I don't know what to say. I'm going to talk to you.
Well, no, that's good. And, as I listened to this whole episode, it really just reinforced, I think, so many of the basic concepts we've been talking about since the very beginning of this show. 5.5 years ago. You know, the importance of regular training, revisiting things that you need to do again and again and again until you get it right, and being flexible, all of those things that you need to put together, especially in these highly technical situations that you run into in an urban search and rescue environment. So the key thing here that I thought that I picked up on today is that you need to do this kind of hands-on experiential training, especially for these types of technical situations. And it's one of the reasons we're excited and are so happy to have Paragon Medical Education Group here sponsoring this program to bring the Disaster Podcast to people. Just as this amazing training was put together by FEMA, Paragon can put together similar types of experiential training. And Joe, you guys have been doing this for such a long time, putting this together and doing this in different jurisdictions and places all over the country and internationally. Where can people reach out to you to come and talk to you so that you can tell them what you can do for them? Because that's really the most important thing they need to do. Don't just rely on what their impressions are on what you can do. They need to call you and get you on the phone and say, this is what we think we need. What can you do for us? Or what do you actually think you can put together for us that we don't even understand we need?
Well, you're exactly right, Jamie. You know, I think in the future, I'm just going to refer them all to talk to Patrick. That'll probably be easier. But you're exactly right. You know, we definitely want to talk to those folks. It's a very customized experience. I think the thing I see most often is people simply don't know what they don't know. And that conversation with us can help kind of give them some ideas they never even thought about and can make their training as unique, intensive, and meaningful as what we heard about tonight.
Where can folks find you and reach out to you to get those questions answered?
You can reach us through the website at ParagonMedicalEducationGroup.com. You can always find us on Facebook under Paragon Medical Group as well, or the Disaster Podcast Facebook page. Please go there and join us. Or you can reach us through the Disaster Podcast website.
Excellent. And thanks again for your continued support. Patrick, are you active on social media, or do you have a way that people want to reach out to you and maybe pick your brain about some of the things you learned at this event?
I'm on Facebook, Patrick McDevitt out of Memphis. That's me. I do the Twitter thing, but I prefer Facebook. I think it's a little bit easier as far as interacting and sharing pictures and stuff. So that's what I'm limited to.
Excellent.
So yeah, absolutely. People are welcome to get in touch with me about anything, questions or whatnot. And you know, I'm happy to share what I know. And as Doc said, I learned a lot about things that I don't know out there too. So I try to be a little humble, and if I don't know something, I'll tell you I don't know. I've been an instructor for about 5 or 6 years in EMS, and one of my big take homes that I always try to tell my students is always ask why something is. Don't just learn something. Ask why something is the way it is. And if you can figure out what the why is, or to explain to somebody what the why is, then you have a better understanding on what you're doing and what you know.
And that's so important. I agree with you 100%. I do the same thing when I teach. And because if you can understand the why, you can adapt to make it work the way it needs to work in difficult situations that don't follow the normal path. And that's so important. So thanks again for coming on. This has been just such an eye-opening episode, and we really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us.
Sure. Thanks, y'all, for having me. I appreciate it.
Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WXKyleNelson. So feel free to connect with me there and continue the conversation.
Great. How about you, Sam?
I am on the usual social media format under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. And we definitely need to get Patrick into our Facebook group on, because he's a Facebook guy. Hook him up there, because we have 600 plus members who may want to ask questions. And on the disasterpodcast.com website. What about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media channels out there. So just search for me under that handle. You'll find me and friend, follow, or otherwise connect with me there. I always love to hear from folks. And of course, you can find us over at our Facebook group on Facebook. Just search Disaster Podcast and ask to join the group. We'd love to have you come in. And like Sam said, we try to bring in our guests and have them be available to answer questions on their episodes when people have questions in the comments there. And we've had some pretty good discussions going on in recent last week or so on a couple of different topics. So, you know, please keep track of what's going on, and you can do that over there in that group. So please keep in touch with us. You know, Sam, I hear about this, and I'll tell you, hearing Patrick describe the different medical evolutions they had to go through with some of these patients during this particular drill, that their final program, as it were, really just lays out how very different this type of medicine is.
And he very eloquently presented what that was like from his perspective. So we appreciate that. But this is probably the best example of the fact that disaster medicine is not for everyday medicine.